Welcome to another episode of the Future Car Podcast. I'm Jeff Cook. Good news, Ed is back today as host. He's been just cranking out the good interviews, so we have a bunch more coming that are in production. This one, it's with Justin Ho, founder of a company called RideOS in San Francisco. Just a quick note, this interview was done in December, and we wound up meeting Justin again at CES in January, and actually did a quick interview with him on camera there, also with one of his data scientists. We have a bunch of CES stuff in production, and we'll let you know when the videos are done and how you can see the interviews. Justin was great on camera as well. A little bit about him. Before RideOS, he was head of strategy at Uber's Advanced Technology Division. He also did stints as an investor and investment banker at Citadel and Goldman. And he's also a super accomplished musician and has even performed at the Kennedy Center. We had some fun cutting in some of his playing into this episode. RideOS, here's how TechCrunch's Kirsten Korosek described the company back in August. Kirsten wrote, "The founders who met at Uber Advanced Technologies Group have developed a cloud-based fleet management platform that pulls mapping, traffic, and detection data to suggest to all self-driving vehicles operating in a given geography the safest, most efficient routes. The aim is to be an independent platform that can orchestrate communication between self-driving vehicle services that may be competitors." Kirsten was writing that in an article about the company's $25 million round of Series B funding, led by Next47. Heard of Next47? It's Siemens' billion-dollar venture arm. Offices in the Valley and elsewhere. Check them out online. They have a good presence on Medium, as does RideOS, in fact. Turns out Next47 is investing in a bunch of transportation companies. We may be featuring a few more of these in the future as well. The cool thing about this conversation, at least for me, these guys, Ed and Justin, sort of seem like kindred spirits. Maybe they're from different generations and different sides of the country, but still, Ed's been through the whole startup lifecycle process. He started a company at Draper Lab, affiliated with MIT. The company was acquired by Siemens in 2011. He's stuck around to mix things up here ever since. Justin is certainly mixing it up with RideOS, reading their news page. They both happen to be musicians, too. And there's a little good-natured Boston versus the Silicon Valley thing that comes up here. Ed asks a question about an innovation all of us nerds want, where it might ultimately come from, Boston's 128 Tech Corridor or the Valley. Justin has a good answer to that one. You'll have to listen to hear what he says. Anyway, now here's Ed and Justin.
Welcome back to another episode of the Future Car Podcast. As you've probably come to discover, if you'd listened to our past episodes, our work, as it relates to the auto industry, is pretty global. I'm Ed Bernardin, the VP of Strategic Automotive Initiatives here at Siemens, and in this week's episode, I interviewed Justin Ho. He's currently the co-founder and CEO of RideOS. Now, his life work revolves around cars, all types of autonomous vehicles, and collecting data to make the rollout of these vehicles a reality. His career is now high tech and all about autonomous cars, but this isn't how he originally imagined his career would turn out. I heard that Justin is actually a master violinist and wondered if it was true and how that influenced his career.
I did until the sobering realities of how much musicians make became very clear to me during my senior year of high school. This was shortly after I had performed at the Kennedy Center, the Tchaikovsky Violin Concerto, which was pretty much the peak of my career. And we had a discussion, a family discussion about where to go to college, where to go to school, and about different career paths. And that was pretty much where there was a decision to not pursue music professionally and full-time.
So you decided to go the route which may be a little bit less risk in making a living, I guess. Is that what drove you that way?
It's part of it, but also most of my life growing up, I actually thought and dreamed of and aspired to become a basketball player. Then the sobering reality hit that not only was my skill level not great enough, but I was also too short. I'm about 5'4". And so that was the end of my basketball dream as well.
There's no height requirement to play violin though, right?
That's true.
So, having played guitar myself my whole life, there is that artistic side, right? And then you end up having the technical side. And sometimes they can pull away from each other, but sometimes in combination, they can be very, very powerful. So has your experience in music as a violinist, has that influenced what you did after that?
It absolutely has, in ways that I would expect, in ways that I would not expect. So playing the violin has, I believe that instruments and art help to shape the brain in ways in which it unleashes our creativity. And there is a lot of dreaming that's required as we look towards the future of transportation and some of the work that we're doing here in terms of bringing fleets of self-driving vehicles to the world, while most companies are still working to get one autonomous vehicle to the road. In terms of the unexpected ways in which playing music has benefited my life, it has helped introduce me to my wife, and also helped to jumpstart my career in multiple ways through the folks that I met along the journey. And so it's been one of the best decisions of my life. I continue to play in a quartet and trio with my wife and some friends, and is hopefully something that will keep up until we die.
The initial part of Justin's career was actually in finance. He worked in investment banking at Goldman Sachs and was an investor at the Citadel Investment Group, and eventually made that big leap into the world of automotive tech. Justin was also a founding team member of Uber's advanced technology division, which consisted of the self-driving and mapping biz units. So in this role, he was a leader in the overall strategy spanning commercialization, techno-economic analysis, and so much more. So I was a little curious to know exactly what motivated his career switch and how his position at Uber developed into working on autonomous vehicles.
So at the time, I was sitting there as an investor at Citadel. But unlike a lot of the investors that were in San Francisco, I was actually covering industrial companies. So the automotive OEMs, the suppliers, logistics companies, trucking companies. And during that time, there was this company called Uber and Lyft and Sidecar at the time. And they were starting to expand in San Francisco to fulfill a personal need that I had and a need that everyone else had in the city of San Francisco, which was to get from point A to point B reliably, safely, and cheaply. And as this business started to grow, and myself and folks around me were toying with the notion of just ditching our cars, I was having these meetings with these big industrial companies, asking them about shared mobility, about how folks that were younger were no longer buying cars, and what they plan to do as a result of this, what I viewed as a disruptive threat. And the response was pretty surprising at the time. A lot of folks told me that Uber works very well in San Francisco, but it will never work in New York, and it will never work in Detroit. And looking at some of the data and some of the rapid growth for some of these technology companies that were focusing on transportation, I had a different view and was fortunate enough, actually through music, to get in touch with Travis at the time at Uber. And one thing led to another, ended up joining there. And it was my first foray into technology and have never looked back.
Your work at Uber was in the area of mapping and routing, those types of things?
So at Uber, I had a variety of different roles, which is one of the great things about joining a hyper-growth company. You get experiences across corporate development, business development, strategy, product management. But there were two primary divisions that I worked with. The first one was helping to determine the long-term mapping strategy for Uber. And that was where I met my co-founder, Chris. He was heading up engineering at the time. And so that's a full suite of Uber's mapping services like ETAs and search and POIs, some of these foundational technologies for ride-hailing to be able to operate. The second division that myself and a few colleagues actually helped to start was the Self-Driving Vehicle Group. That at the time, it was the Advanced Technology Center based out of Pittsburgh. And that started off with just a few folks in a room brainstorming about what the future might look like and starting to get deep into the industry.
As Justin mentioned, Uber was a hyper-growth company when he joined. Now it's at the forefront of the development, innovation, and eventual rollout of autonomous vehicles. And Justin played a key role in getting this group started and leading it onto its path of success and innovation. Since there's so much excitement and innovation happening with Uber under his leadership, I had to ask, why leave? Why did he leave Uber?
For most of my life, I've actually dreamed of becoming an entrepreneur. So my career actually started even before Goldman. I think my first foray into starting a business was in high school. So during high school, I noticed that there was a problem. And the problem, I grew up in Cupertino, was that a lot of kids wanted pets, but a lot of parents did not want to maintain them and pay a high upkeep for them. And so I started looking around and noticed that turtles were actually potentially a good business. So I ended up importing with my friend thousands of turtles from Florida for about a dollar each, which we then resold for $10. And that was really my first foray into starting a very, very small business. That passion for an entrepreneurial spirit continued throughout college, where I started selling polos. My dorm room was full of polos, and this continued even into my career in finance and at Uber. And there was a turning point about shortly after 3 years at Uber. Myself and my co-founder Chris, we had always loved working together. We had a perfect set of complementary skills, and with some encouragement from my wife and his wife, we decided to make the decision to start a company even before we knew what the company was going to do. And we made that decision and took the leap and haven't looked back since.
In any business, there's always key moments when you have to convince someone to invest in you, whether it's money, space, or anything else that an entrepreneur might need. In Justin's turtle business, there was a point where his parents had to get involved since Justin was housing hundreds or thousands of turtles in his garage. In that crucial moment, Justin did not ask for permission from his parents and instead went ahead with his business plan. Similarly, here in Cambridge, Mass., near where I live, a scooter rental company deployed scooters throughout the city without asking for permission. Of course, the authorities eventually intervened and pulled them off the street. But once these scooters were gone, there was a community outcry to have them back. So now Cambridge is working with the scooter company to make this happen. So sometimes this strategy does work. Maybe that's a something that the turtle business taught Justin.
As I get older, there's definitely an aspect which is run fast and do what we think is right. But there are certainly, you know, especially in the industry that we operate in, bringing fleets of self-driving vehicles to market, there is an aspect which needs to be done in conjunction with authorities and regulators. And we believe that these types of partnerships will be critical for the scaled rollout of self-driving vehicles.
Now, Justin has moved up from the turtle business. He is the co-founder and CEO of RideOS. RideOS powers on-demand mobility services that consist of human-driven and self-driven vehicles. His company enables companies to accelerate the deployment of their fleets, expand service coverage, and operate safer and more profitable transportation networks, all while benefiting from the scale and performance of the cloud. But with companies like Uber and Lyft developing in this area, I wondered why the marketplace needs RideOS.
The marketplace needs RideOS because today, there's actually not software in the cloud that allows for the safe and efficient management of fleets of mixed human-driven vehicles and self-driving vehicles. And the reason is because most of the software today, like routing and dispatch and some of these services that populate these on-demand fleets, the reason is because these pieces of software were built specifically for human drivers and the roads of today. So one of the key differences that we see between humans and autonomous vehicles is that self-driving vehicles are going to come to the world initially just in small pockets of the city with limited capabilities. And over time, as the technology gets more mature, they will add more and more capabilities. So an example of that might be unprotected left turns. During 4 to 6 p.m. And in most major cities, an unprotected turn when there's high traffic is actually very difficult for humans to drive. And if it's difficult for humans to drive, then it's also difficult for a self-driving vehicle. That's usually a pretty good proxy. And today there's still a lot of what we call constraints, unprotected left turns, potholes, harsh weather, construction, things that are difficult for humans, which are also difficult for self-driving vehicles. And in order to bring these fleets to market, one of the solutions that we believe, which is going to help with the safe and efficient rollout, is to route these fleets around the constraints that they have not yet solved. And so you can imagine a section of San Francisco where there are routes, safe routes, for self-driving vehicles that take into account what an autonomous vehicle can do versus can't do, and routes the fleet around those different types of constraints. And we believe that that's going to help with the safe and efficient rollout as we look towards tens and thousands of self-driving vehicles.
On the RideOS website, it says that RideOS technology enables you to accelerate deployment of your fleets and expand service coverage. But what does that mean?
Yeah, so the best way to explain this is to look at the use case. So let's imagine the entire city of, let's say, Los Angeles, and we're 5 to 10 years into the future, and this is a mix of public transport, it's a mix of self-driving vehicles, and it's a mix of human drivers. One of the things that we believe, in order to have that type of coverage service area that's wide, that really services the needs of folks from all over the city, there needs to be a RideOS in the cloud that is helping provide services that allow for the safe and efficient operation of all these different fleets. And so one of the unique things about our technologies is that we can support many different types of vehicles, all with different coverage capabilities. So human might be able to cover all parts of LA, and there might be some humans that want to only drive in Santa Monica. With that, there also might be self-driving vehicles that only cover a section of downtown Los Angeles. And we have software, dispatch, routing, supply positioning, types of algorithms that can help to facilitate that mixed fleet in terms of a use case. So we support various different types of vehicles, various different types of constraints, and we can support various different types of data formats to make all of that possible. The reason why flexibility is important is because mobility is changing so quickly. We just talked about scooters earlier. You know, that's taking the market by a storm. And so is, you know, self-driving vehicle continues to develop as well. So flexibility of routes, flexibility of where vehicles need to be in order to allow for the efficient transportation of humans and goods, that's a key point, as well as creating a data platform that's able to ingest many different types of map data, which you talked about. So the map data that is built for self-driving vehicles is actually completely different than the map data for human-driven vehicles of today. It's much more detailed. You know where all the, for humans today, what we described it as is, it is an inch deep, but mile wide. So you'll get, you know, road level graphs. You don't necessarily need to know where all the traffic lights are. You do have rough speed limits. You know where the intersections and the junctions are. When you look at map data for self-driving vehicles, it's much more rich. The self-driving vehicles depend upon the map data in order to make a lot of key decisions. As a result, you need to map out where all the curbs are, where all the traffic lights are, and a lot of other traffic signals as well too. So creating a data platform in the cloud that's able to ingest various different types of data formats. That's also something that we're working really hard to build here at RideOS.
During extra busy times on the roads or in an area that recently had an accident, many popular platforms like Waze or Google Maps have the ability to alert the user and reroute them around a congested area. But that's high-level general information. I wanted to know how RideOS gets the detailed data that an autonomous vehicle has to have in order to reroute itself around traffic. How does this detailed data get to the application so the vehicle knows how to change course?
Yeah, so we have a platform. We're building a platform here of cloud services. They're a la carte. So companies come to us with a variety of different use cases, oftentimes related to on-demand transportation, and we offer them a mix of different services like dispatch and routing in order to help them bring their on-demand fleets to market. And as you talked about, one of the key pieces is data. And so today we build a lot of services and we license data to make those services better. So we are able to, just for example, our services work with OSM, OpenStreetMaps, which is a source of base map data. And we also announced a deal as well with TomTom to get GPS traffic probe data as well to make routing more efficient. And what's unique about our data platform is that it's very flexible. So we can work with a variety, and we set up the architecture as such, to be able to ingest lots of different types of data sources. And we put in a lot of engineering effort into making sure that we can match them and conflate the different types of data to make sure our services are very valuable.
You mentioned you have a partnership with TomTom, and of course there's TomTom, and then there's Garmin, and then, you know, there's, again, Google has all the users with cell phones that are using Waze or whatever it might be. And then of course you got Uber and you got Lyft, and they've got information on where their cars are. But all this information isn't available to everyone, right? And in order to do routing, don't you have to know about most, if not almost all, the vehicles that are on the road to do it properly?
So there's routing of today, and then there's routing of tomorrow. And actually, for most of the companies that you mentioned, they actually don't have the data about every single available, all the data that's available from all the vehicles that are driving on the road today, and they're still able to come up with efficient algorithms. I think what's pretty interesting is as we look towards the scale deployment of self-driving vehicles coming with human-driven vehicles, what are the types of data that are missing today that are going to be critical for this rollout? And a lot of that is actually collected by no companies today. So if we look at a map of San Francisco, it's hard to tell where all the construction zones are on a lane-level basis, where all the harsh weather is occurring in different pockets of the city, because the world is dynamic. It's always changing. And so as we look towards 5 years from now, a lot of the data that's going to be required for the safe rollout of self-driving vehicles is missing. And we're working on a host of different partnerships in order to try to access that source of data. Another related concept is we do believe that there are various types of data that need to be shared among different self-driving vehicle companies today. And the reason why we believe this is important is because ultimately the end goal for every company is similar. We want to help improve the safe transportation of humans. And so we believe that data, specifically critical intervention data, for different autonomous vehicle developers, critical intervention data is, you know, I gave some examples, but they're effectively things in the real world that cause the safety driver to take over or for the self-driving vehicle to do something dangerous, whether it's pulling for a safe stop, having the safety driver take over, or the self-driving vehicle crashing into something. We believe that those things in the real world that are dynamic in nature, you know, need to be shared among different companies. As we start building towards that world, we'll see self-driving vehicles and be able to realize the benefits for consumers much sooner.
This data is extremely valuable, maybe even more valuable than actually moving people around. So companies won't necessarily be interested in sharing their data with other companies. But sharing this data could be a crucial step to the eventual safe rollout of autonomous vehicles on the road. So some of this information needs to be shared, like data related to safety, such as a pothole in the road or an accident ahead. If companies could universally agree on a classification system of data to define safety data, routing data, mapping data, and whatever else, the exchange of safety data could be much easier. Unfortunately, there is currently no universal classification system for this data. The majority of companies just aren't focused on collecting and, more importantly, sharing this type of information just yet.
One of the reasons why this hasn't really become pervasive throughout the industry is because the industry is still nascent. You know, folks are still trying to figure out how to get a car to drive as safely as possible to human levels. And so a lot of folks are focused on that problem. And a lot of talented, you know, former colleagues of mine and close friends are working on solving that problem. And that's one of the reasons why here at RideOS, we want to accelerate towards that world. And that's why we've built these flexible services. And also we have a data schema that can work with many different types of data. We're hoping that as a result of pushing forward these types of services and schema, that we can help move the industry forward to a point in which safety critical data is shared for the benefit of millions of consumers much, much faster.
So what's the role of government in all this? I mean, shouldn't they just step in and say, hey, you have to share safety data because we want to keep everyone safe up on the road, especially as autonomous cars start coming onto the roads together with human drivers. Is the government doing that? Should they do that?
It depends on the geography. And one of the things about self-driving vehicles, it's very much a global business. You know, we view it as the great space race of the 21st century. And why is it the space race of the 21st century? It's because transportation is a fundamental need for folks in order to lift economies. And we believe that transportation should be operated safely, as in people and goods should be moved from point A to point B without needing to worry about those types of issues, and it should be offered cheaply. That's one of the benefits of self-driving vehicles, which is transportation will be, in many cases, cheaper than public transport today. Massive, massive price drops versus the price in which it costs to take Uber and Lyft around the world. And in order to facilitate that, you know, we do believe that, you know, government plays an important role. To see self-driving at scale, and this is one of the most fascinating things about the space, you really need the technologists, the software technologists, the roboticists, the fleet management folks to come together with the automotive industry, to come together with government and regulators, and then also for consumers to adopt this before we see this at scale.
Autonomous cars are great, right? And I know I've read some of your other interviews, and many out there are saying how the cost for transportation per mile is going to get down to that 30, 35 cents, 40 cents, whatever it might be, which is exciting. But with lower prices comes higher demand. And with higher demand for travel is going to lead to more congested streets and things like that. And so a key piece to the future has got to be public transportation or trains or scooters or ability to move faster on a sidewalk, multi-mode transportation. So how does what you're doing with routing just cars, is there a plan to expand that to say, hey, if I want to go from point A to point B, take a car, ride hailing service, and then take a train or a scooter or a bike or whatever? Are there any plans to look at multi-mode transportation?
Yeah, absolutely. And we believe that's going to be a critical part of the future. In fact, we've very much built our services, our cloud services like routing and dispatch today, to be able to support different types of vehicles, whether it's higher capacity, whether it's a scooter, whether it's a self-driving vehicle or a human-driven vehicle. We can support all of that and the unique constraints to each type of vehicle and what they're trying to optimize for. That's one of the key differentiations for the way that we've built our technology. And it's very much in support of the world that you talk to, where we don't believe that transportation is going to be dominated by one modality or another. It's going to be various forms of transport that are in cooperation with each other to service different needs for consumers, and safety and then efficiency become the predominant requirements in order to lift economies.
What about the financial part of that? Because I would imagine if the optimal ride is scooter, car, train, let's just say, that's three different providers that need to be paid. Now, would RideOS handle the scheduling and the payment and all that too?
That's something that we could definitely support. Our mission here is to accelerate the safe global rollout of next generation transport. And while we are focused today on building cloud services, that could extend to whatever different types of problems. You know, what motivates us here is to just help this industry get to deployment faster in a safe way. And if that means that we need to help to handle some of the payments, if this means that we need to help with different areas and build services in service of those different needs, that's something that we're absolutely willing to take a look at.
So what is your business model? I mean, is it to sell to fleet owners, or is it going to be getting apps in, on people's phones and selling advertising ultimately? What is your strategy?
So we have a platform of cloud services, and we, you know, charge folks in order to license those services. And they use these services in order to operate their fleets of vehicles, whether it's an on-demand or a scheduled type of use case. It's not too dissimilar to, let's say, GCP or AWS, Amazon Web Services, where they have a host of cloud services that are a la carte, that are flexible, where companies can use those services in order to start their small business. That's how we view our business model.
The culture around transportation has already significantly changed in the last few years. Justin doesn't even own a car himself. Instead, he relies purely on a combination of ride-sharing services to get around town or other on-demand services to rent a car when he has to leave town. So let's go 20 years in the future, San Francisco, right? What's your vision of what transportation is like in the city? So for instance, are internal combustion engine cars going to be banned, or is self-owned cars going to be banned? What's the nature of the vehicles that are moving us around? How do you see this evolving? Because obviously you can get around and without a car, no problem, right? How's this going to unfold? Take us to the future.
So I'm still waiting for someone on our team. You know, we've been fortunate to have such a talented team of extremely sharp individuals that are way smarter than I am to come up with an idea for teleportation. Because I do, if we're looking at with a 20-year type of time frame, that would be a super interesting type of modality.
Wouldn't that put you out of business?
Well, we could be part of
the teleporting business.
Yeah, we could be part of the teleporting business.
That's good. As long as it's in your business plan, then you're all set.
That's right. Next generation transport might be, you know, human-driven vehicles in some markets and teleportation in others. Again, we don't. You know, we think about things very, very broadly. It's kind of just extrapolating out from some of the current technology trends that we're seeing today. There's a few things that we observe. One is that there will be mass scale self-driving vehicle transport that is cheap. The car of the future might look very different than the car of today. There might be mobile conference rooms. There also should be a lot less vehicles on the road as well. Like if all the vehicles on the road are shared, then we just don't need that many different types of vehicles. Ideally, we see a lot of different infrastructure enhancements in order to help move people more efficiently. You know, the traffic light systems of today, you know, all of us have probably been at the first in the traffic light when there's nobody on the other side of the road. You know, the traffic light should turn green. That's an efficiency that can start to bring time back towards folks.
Another aspect of autonomous cars, which I think would impact your business, is everything we've talked about up to now is about moving a person or a package or whatever, a cargo from point A to B. But it may be that while you're moving, you may want to do other things, like, for instance, well, there's obviously, you know, like first class, economy class or whatever, but there could also be, I want an office car or a diner car or a movie car or I don't know, whatever it might be, right? Have you thought much about that as to It's almost like another dimension on the routing problem. Is that something that you're considering as something that may be important in the future?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a few things there. The first one is, what do consumers actually want as we have this radical trend to reinvent the transportation experience? Right, a lot of people just want to get around cheaply, in which there's solutions for that, whether it's getting manufacturing existing vehicles with more durable, with durability enhancements such that the parts last longer, and also bringing down the manufacturing costs. There's also, like you said, the potential for many different types of transport as well to the service the needs at different price points for what folks are looking for, including the idea of a mobile office room as well.
We've talked a lot about what is going on behind the scenes to develop the future of autonomous vehicles and data collection. But on a lighter note, I had to ask Justin a very specific question. We joke a little bit about the Transporter and all that, but it actually is an interesting vision, right? Transporter 1.0, whenever that might happen, be it 30 or 40 or 100 or 200 years from now. I guess what's probably more interesting is what's going to be the version of the transportation that's the last bit of transportation that's right before that Transporter, right? Even that's probably hard to imagine. But listen, any last things you'd like to tell us before we sign off here?
Two final thoughts. The first one is, we do believe that companies from all over the world need to come together to create this next generation traffic control system. And so we invite different partners to come and join us in achieving this mission. And the second one is, you know, we're continuing to look for smart, talented, hungry people that want to come and learn to be able to create this vision. And so, soft plug, but you know, my email is justin@rideos.ai, and really welcome feedback and any types of emails at any time.
Big thanks to Justin Ho for making time for this interview today and telling us all about RideOS and what to look forward to in the future. Thanks for joining us today, and for more, visit Siemens PLM Software online. Siemens PLM Software is a world's leading provider of product lifecycle management and manufacturing operation management software. We help thousands of companies realize innovation by optimizing their processes from planning and development through manufacturing, production, and support.
Okay, big thanks to Justin and Ed, also to Jenny and her team for the nifty editing. I feel like dusting off my saxophone from high school, but I mean, the Kennedy Center? Come on, how can you compete with that? Next time, an interview with Amitai Bin-Nun, Vice President of Autonomous Vehicles and Mobility Innovation at Securing America's Energy Future in Washington, D.C. Before Amitai was a policy guy, well, he has a PhD in theoretical astrophysics from Penn, and he did research on black holes as a window into extra dimensions. Another smart guy. Can he help me with the black hole that is my inbox? Speaking of which, send an email or voice memo and let me know if we can use it on the show. Still would love to do that. It's jeff_cook@mentor.com. That's jeff_koch@mentor.com. Thanks for listening. See you next time.